Most people get their news and views through social media nowadays. On Twitter, it's becoming a centralized hub where you can follow along with anybody's opinion, whether they are the most respected news reporter that's out there, or it's simply a neighbor down the street that likes to think about what they read or see on the news. This individual started following me after I appeared on a few Twitter spaces with Mario Narfal, but they've also had the ear of Sarah Silverman, Elon Musk, responding to a lot of their tweets. They got a following like 360,000 people. But I'd never actually spoken with this individual until today. I wanted to find out, how does somebody go from being really far to the right as a MAGA Republican to somebody who now states that they are a proud liberal Democrat and really espouses all the things that I see on MSNBC and Rachel Maddow saying? I wanted to find out, how does one person go from one spot to the other? And could I help that individual see a little bit more into the middle, which is where I try to live most of my life, seeing things from both sides. And I wanted to make sure that my guest was able to do so as well, because I really enjoyed the way that he approaches his Twitter page each day. He doesn't really get in arguments with people. He just simply states his opinion and he holds firm onto that. And so this conversation, first half is getting to know him. Second half, I ask him to explain and I push back a little bit. And I hope that you really enjoy the respectful dialogue that we have. So sit back, grab yourself a cup of coffee or whatever it is that you're into. You're listening to America Emboldened with Greg Bolden on the America Out Loud Network.
America Emboldened.
Greg, I feel emboldened.
You don't know what they did. You don't know what they sacrificed. We have lost touch with the principles in the Constitution. Nobody's read the Declaration of Independence. You are voting for socialism, and you got what you voted for.
Welcome, bold Americans, to another episode of America Emboldened. I'm your host, Greg Bolden, here on the America Out Loud Network. As always, go to www.americaoutloud.com, where you can see hundreds of articles each week by all of my colleagues and differing viewpoints, things that you might agree with, disagree with, but I guarantee you it's going to make you think about your stance and what you're doing. And so it's been an America First type of network, and they allow me on here, so I'm very thankful for it. Today, I am joined by somebody who I've been on Twitter spaces with when Mario Narfal invites me on. I've found this gentleman who is a former Army veteran, or I guess he is an Army veteran. You don't become a former one. He's also a former Trump supporter. He's a former Republican, and he now states that he's a proud liberal Democrat. He does a political opinion writing. He is a wrestling fan, so we're going to talk a little about that too today, and we'll have a little fun with that. And he lives on Twitter 24/7. I'm always amazed at this gentleman and everything that he's able to put out content-wise. I don't always agree with him, but I wanted to bring him onto the show because I like to try to melt down the right-left slant and just get the people's views and have cordial conversations. And so today I bring you David Weissman. You can find David at David Weissman. There's an M in between for his middle name. So it's at David M. Weissman, W-E-I-S-S-M-A-N on Twitter. Feel free to give him a follow after listening to the show or while you're listening to it. David, welcome to America Emboldened.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Oh, I'm so glad to have you on. So let's first start off. How long have you been posting on Twitter? I know that you joined back in 2012, but when would you say that you became an ultra user? Because you put out a ton of posts each day.
Yeah, I joined around 2012, but I didn't really become active until like around 2014, 2015, where I started getting more vocal. I mainly posted on Facebook. I did a lot of that, and I was conservative then. I was at, before I joined MAGA and became a Trump supporter, I was actually in a Tea Party conservative Republican, you know, that side of the spectrum in the Republican Party. And I was offered a writing gig called the Conservative Underground. And you know, that's, you know, so the more activism I did, then I, you know, decided, you know, just let's go ahead and join Twitter, you know, get a more of an audience, you know, more reach of my work. And, you know, that's where it started. And that's where it took off from there.
Okay. So at, how long were you a Republican? Were you a lifelong Republican since you started the vote or? Okay.
So this is it's kind of funny that said, because like, you know, when I did leave the Republican Party, you know, especially like MAGA, you know, you bring a lot of like cult-like people that will try to disprove your story. So, you know, there are times where I actually had to pull my voting records, you know, back when I was 18, old enough to vote, and prove, yes, I was a lifelong Republican, and show when I registered as a Democrat. It was like, for some reason, in a Florida registry, like, it has me as a Democrat since 2016, which is wrong, of course. So, their system, and it's for me, and I'm actually trying to get it fixed, but they couldn't do it. So, you know, I brought in the unredacted forms. Yeah, I've been a lifelong Republican, and, you know, stay that way until around 2019, where I officially became a Democrat.
Okay, so I want to get into that in just a few moments, but you mentioned early on there that you went, the Tea Party was something that kind of like drew you in and eventually made it into MAGA, which is an interesting thing for you to point out, because I've often said to my listeners that when I identify where Republicans lost their way, it starts with the Tea Party. The Tea Party, in theory, had a good concept behind it, but then it got hijacked by kind of a far right ideology by certain individuals, and it lost its luster. And after that, the Republicans kind of were the perfect victim, so to speak, for Donald Trump to show up, because they had lost their conservative values. They had lost their ability to take a moral high ground. And then you have entered Donald Trump, the reality star himself from The Apprentice, all the different billions of dollars in real estate. And so I've always thought that the Tea Party kind of set the stage for Trump's presidency. Did you see in your own kind of ideologies back then that because you were part of that Tea Party support, that that led you more to a Donald Trump type of candidate versus some of the others that were on stage, the Jeb Bushes, the Marco Rubios?
To tell people how right wing I was actually a 10 Cruz supporter in the primaries. It was kind of funny. I sure had a good taste in Republicans, but they had differences in some of their beliefs, but it was like really very, very similar. So it was easy to jump ship, you know, from the Cruz crew, as he called it, to the Trump train.
All right. So what attracted you to the Trump train? Because I didn't vote for Donald Trump in the 2016 election. I voted for Gary Johnson during that election because I was really concerned that this guy was going to enrich his family and not enrich the country. In some ways, I think that I was wrong about Donald Trump. In other ways, I think I was right. But I'm curious, what attracted you to him?
Similar ideology to Ted Cruz. And yeah, you're right. A lot of the problems that we see from the far right has been coming for a long time. Tea Party days, a lot of the anger, misinformation, different things like that. It was such a huge buildup to where the GOP is now. And yeah, it was easy. I mean, I mainly watched Fox News growing up. I started posting on Facebook, so I belong to a lot of different conservative Facebook groups, and you know, I started listened to a lot of different conservative radio, been on conservative radio as a speaker myself, and so it was very easy to believe some of the stuff that, you know, I thought was true. You know, like, you know, the war against Muslims, you know, immigration, different things like that. The Democrats were the enemy of America, and you want to take your rights away, religious freedom away. There were so many different things that they made you believe, and the thing is, you know, these people were religious, and I was a lot more religious back then too. I was more of Orthodox Jew, very, very religious at the time, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, these people were lying to me because they're religious, they believe in God. You know, I took their word for it. You know, people like Hannity, people like, you know, so many, like I said, a lot of conservative talk radio, Glenn Beck, I listen to different people like that, Blaze, and so I never questioned it. You know, I always felt that they had America at heart. And I believed them. I believed in the whole deep state thing. So, you know, like I said, that's why it was so easy to go from Ted Cruz to Trump. And it's both were very similar. I mean, you're seeing Ted Cruz now, the way he just defends Trump. No problem. Like, he gives up, you know, he gave up his constitutional principles, you know, to defend that man. And I'm just guessing he really believes in or keep his base, but
he just has to make sure that there's not a mirror that he doesn't look good in.
but yeah,
when, so, yeah. When so, Ted Cruz comes around, I think he's going to run again for president here. He'll announce. And that's the reason why he takes the stand that he does. He doesn't want to alienate MAGA voters. Yeah. He doesn't want to all of a sudden find himself. Now, what's interesting about you is I now want to kind of shift to, why did you move away from Donald Trump? You wrote this thing back in 2020. I thought that Donald Trump was for me, but I realized that I was wrong. You stated that you didn't feel that Trump was representing all Americans, not just, he was just representing his base. And some of the things that you've talked about, I wanted to kind of dive into, because I believe that you, much like many other people, have lots of opinions that you've also developed from throughout the years here, from media as well. And so I guess my question is, as we're talking about Hannity not having your side, I'm curious, you know, the stories that you did get that kind of made you change your mind about Trump, how much of that was your own observations and how much of that was other types of media influencing those talking points too? So let's start with, what was the worldview changer with Donald Trump? When were you like, well, we got a problem?
It was kind of like two stories in one. I was pretty much a troll, want to call it that. I was, you know, on Twitter, trolling celebrities, trolling Democratic politicians. And this is a time where it's really funny because conservatives have always been crying about being censored for years on Twitter. And I, you know, of course, I believe it. And I took a screenshot of Sarah Silverman, Stephen Colbert in their Nazi outfits, you know, part of their comedy routine. And I was being a dick. And someone, you know, said, like, hey, Jack, you know, with the owner of Twitter at the time, it's like, why are you sounding conservative but letting these crazy liberals run amok? You know, paraphrasing, of course, but
sure.
And surprisingly, Sarah Silverman responded, which I didn't expect to, because normally when you reply to a celebrity, you can't block at the time. And she replied in a polite way, explaining about how comedy is subjective, and, you know, and learned that she was kind of right about that. And then I kind of thought about, you know, she's Jewish, I'm Jewish. Why doesn't she like Trump? He's pro-Israel. You know, main Jerusalem, you know, the capital of Israel, because, you know, that's a very controversial statement right there in itself. So she replied again. And it was in a civil manner. And she told me why she didn't like Trump. I told her why I did. And there was no arguing, no name calling, no fighting. And I just kind of got curious. I'm like, okay, so why do liberals believe that crazy things that they do, you know, because conservatives will always think that what liberals believe is crazy, it's far-fetched, it's, you know, extreme. So then I started asking her, you know, different questions about what liberals really believe in compared to what we're told to believe in. And when she was explaining to me things, like, other people saw what was going on, and, you know, they kind of came into the conversation, so I learned the truth about their, you know, the actual interpretation of the Second Amendment. I learned truths about immigration, seeking asylum, and all that stuff. I mean, heck, cartels, they go through the port of entry, you know? It's never really about a wall or, you know, caravans and all that stuff. So a lot of the stuff that I learned seemed to be built based off of lies of what the world, you know, liberals believe in. Then I learned about Hillary Clinton, how she actually proved her innocence of some of the things that Republicans have used for. Because it really seems like an alternate reality in the sense of the portrayal of Democrats in office. So one thing kind of led to another, and I'm like, why are Republicans lying to get elected? You know, I was still supporting Trump. And with Trump, I mean, I knew he wasn't perfect. I mean, at the time, I kind of felt like he was a guy, you know, man's man. He was, you know, he didn't make mistakes. You all made mistakes. I just didn't realize how corrupt he was. I didn't know much about his history. I didn't know that he dodged a draft or anything like that. You know, I just basically see him as a man being a man. You know, and you know, he was a celebrity because, you know, he's been in movies, TV shows, and all that stuff. So, you know, so right now at this point, I decided to leave the Republican Party because I realized it was a lot of BS, and I was pretty shocked about that. I mean, there's a Democrat who created a GI Bill, you know, because they always said that, you know, Democrats don't support veterans. And of course, we see how opposite that is today. And so a lot of the stuff that I believe was wrong, and I felt like I've been lied to many years. I started the Republican Party, and then I was getting backlash from MAGA just for having dialogue with Democrats. So I had no intention of becoming a Democrat at the time, and, or ending my support from Trump. And I decided, you know what, I'm not going to be part of a group that has a problem with me inside civil conversations. And then I started to see what people are saying about Trump. And I saw how he was a divider, not a uniter. And then I started, you know, people were bringing me information about his past. You know, when, you know, Russia, you know, the crookedness that he's done with money, people.
So I got to ask you here. So I, you spent the majority of the first part of your life as a Republican, moving into the Tea Party, then funding yourself into MAGA, becoming kind of a troll online. I think I followed that pretty well. And so your convictions sound like they were pretty well ingrained in you if you were going as far as I can troll people. And then you have this interaction with comedian Sarah Silverman, who kind of takes a moment of kindness, it sounds like, to not engage in an ugly type of conversation, but rather educate you on, hey, I think you're a little bit wrong, and other people joined in. Correct. But here's my question. Have you thought that some of their talking points might be just as flawed as the talking points that were given to you from the right? Because this is where I find myself at times at. Like I find myself, someone give me a great argument from the left, a great argument from the right, and I find the truth is often somewhere in the middle, and that there's a far left and a far right.
There is. And I told myself that I will never fall into that trap about taking an abundance word for it. So, I start watching NBC, MSNBC now, and I love certain commentators in there. But even with that, I no longer just take a word for it. Like, when it comes to Trump's impeachment, I read the transcript of the phone call that he had with Ukrainian, Zelensky leadership. And I read the Constitution, you know, where it talks about asking favors of a foreign leader. And I, you know, come up with my own line, like, you know, hey, he deserves to be impeached. You know, he shouldn't be in office. So, you know, with that said, you know, I try my, so it is easy to sort of fall into that trap of the echo chamber. You know, what side you're on. And both sides can kind of like have their own like propaganda. So, you know, I don't know if it's intentional on the left, maybe some of it is, some of it isn't.
Because you cite Donald Trump and the impeachment with Ukraine, but I find that, you know, if they had the numbers at the time, they likely could have gotten done a deal with Joe Biden, his own Ukrainian nightmare, when he threatened the Ukrainian president, Petro Poroshenko, saying, if you don't fire that lawyer, you're not getting the money, when Obama administration was covering it. And all of a sudden, the lawyer got fired, the deal got done, which is quid pro Joe, as I'll label it that. I mean, and that's what I'm getting at with, I think that you can manipulate information to go with a side one way or the other, like the right or the left. Like I've worked in media, MSNBC, Fox News. I don't believe really anything that comes out of any of the opinion pieces. I actually was in DC about 3 months ago at the Rage Against the War Machine rally. I was backstage interviewing people like Tulsi Gabbard, Dennis Kucinich,
Jimmy Dore and a bunch of others. It was a great time. Got to meet lots of different political ideologies. Ron Paul was there. Got to finally speak with him for the first time, and that was awesome. But as I'm there, I'm like, wow, this is just an event that's asking for peace to end the war in the Ukraine. There was, when Tulsi Gabbard came up to speak, all of a sudden these old Russian flags started going up. And I could tell that there had to be a group there that was organizing against her. Well, I watched the MSNBC footage, and Rachel Maddow covers this as there were neo-Nazis at this rally, that it was all people pro-Russia. That's why they don't want, you know, the Ukraine war. And then I saw the actual news coverage of it on MSNBC, where the person's like, oh, it's a small turnout, but there were people from the right and the left and moderates, and they were just calling for peace. I was like, wow, that's honest. That MSNBC got the news honest there. Rachel Maddow lied to her listeners and sensationalized the entire thing, just like, you know, you got Sean Hannity doing on Fox News every day. And so I heard what you were saying earlier, like you go to MSNBC, but I think at this point in time, one of the most powerful medias, and what we're going to talk about here in the second half of the show, because it's where both of you and I are existing right now, is in the Twitter space. Right. Like voices like yours that calls to try to fact check people, voices like mine that publish a show Monday through Friday to 100,000 to 200,000 people per day. We now have a new form of media that's never been seen before. And with that comes great responsibility to make sure that we get our facts correct, or that we're able to say, you know what, I was wrong about that. So on the second half, I want to ask you about some of these views about the Second Amendment, things that you believe now that you're a proud liberal, versus maybe where my views might be as somebody who's very much in the middle of a moderate, and see if you're kind of too far to the left for my liking, and how you would respond to me saying that. Because I think that that's, and again, this isn't like I got you type of conversation. Right. This is simply just a conversation of, I just want to understand how this country gets so polarized where people can't have these type of conversations. So I appreciate you being on here today to have this. All right, everybody, we're going to hit a break right now. If you can go to AmericaOutloud.com, you see all of our sponsors. That helps keeps the lights on. One of the products that I do use is Cofix RX. It's a povidone iodine nasal spray. It is clinically proven to help protect you from viruses and bacteria for 8 hours after you make that spray. The science is in. I've been sent the peer-reviewed studies. My wife uses this all the time. Matter of fact, she stopped using it right before Easter, and after 2 weeks of not using it, she got sick, and she's like, I should have been using it. And so it's a product. It works really well. If you, just for listening to the show and going to AmericaOutloud.com, go click on the link. You get a discount just for being a part of this family. All right, everybody, we'll be right back after the break. You're listening to America Emboldened with Greg Bolden and my special guest, David Weissman, here on the America Out Loud Network.
Whether you're an independent, a Democrat, or a Republican, one thing remains true. Airborne viruses love us equally. You've all heard Malcolm and the great Dr. Peter McCullough talk about the advanced nasal solution Cofix RX. Cofix is made in the USA and recommended by thousands of doctors and pharmacists nationwide. Spray goodbye to colds and flus with a Cofix RX nasal solution cleanse. That's COFIXRX.com. Save 20% by using promo code OUTLOUD at COFIXRX.com.
Millions of Americans are needlessly suffering from the long-haul effects of the toxic spike protein. Dr. Peter McCullough and his team at The Wellness Company designed their spike support formula to counteract harmful spike protein from COVID-19 and vaccines so you can feel your best. Go to OutLoudCare.com today and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order.
Welcome back, bold Americans. We just finished a first segment getting to know David Weissman. Now, David has about 360,000 followers on Twitter. You can follow him at David M. Weissman right on Twitter. Go join him, and you'll hear some views that are now of a proud liberal Democrat. And as you know, on my show, I have everybody on, all voices. I think it's really important to have this type of dialogue. I don't think that I agree with everything that David would say, and I don't think David would agree with everything that I'd say, but we can at least respectfully have this conversation and bring it to the masses today so that way we understand it. So now that we know his journey, we're going to get into a little bit about his views. And this is the part where maybe I might push back a little bit, David, and just kind of make sure that we're on the same page, but I'll do it gently. I promise I'm not going to scare you off. All right, David. So you mentioned that during this time, you started realizing that there were lies about politicians like Hillary Clinton, President Obama, and you felt that everything that you had heard from conservatives was a lie. And you were told about, hey, you just don't understand the left's view on things like the Second Amendment. So let's start there. What was the view of the left that you now believe about the Second Amendment? Because I'd like to kind of tell you my thoughts after I hear yours, and maybe we can come to some common ground.
Well, I believe that it is misinterpreted a bit. I mean, yes, it does say the right to bear arms, which I do believe every American should have the right to bear arms. But excuse me, I don't believe that every weapon should be in the arms of civilians, like AR-15s, like guns that can do a lot of damage, you know, like mass shootings. Everything is like that. I think that should be banned. That should be off the streets. And I think I do believe in states' rights, but I do believe when it comes to things like that, every state should be at the same page. So we don't have places like Chicago where, you know, they have the strict gun laws, but, you know, people bring weapons. Excuse me. We will bring weapons from other states that are lax. So I think every state and city should be in the same page when it comes to that. You know, it talks about a well-regulated militia. You see, like, the Proud Boys or other, what I believe are terrorist organizations, march in and try to intimidate people with their weapons. And, you know, that's not okay. That's definitely against the Second Amendment. So, you know, the right, extreme right, anybody likes to misinterpret that, and I think that's not okay for the country.
All right, so you are a former army veteran, correct? So you're familiar with firearms?
Yes, I do have experience shooting different kind of firearms.
Okay, so I guess I would just look at what point is something a more extreme weapon of war versus a just weapon for self-defense hunting? How would you define that? Because I heard you say AR-15. I own an AR-15, and it's more kind of a fun range type of thing. I'm not going to probably go out hunting with it anytime soon. But that all stated, it's fun to go to a range with. And when I have it, I don't see it as a weapon of war. But I'm curious what identifies that as a weapon of war for you. And so that way, maybe I can understand from my standpoint.
Well, if you're going to research of the AR-15, and yes, I know AR-15 does not stand for assault rifle, arm right, or something like that. That's what it stands for. And but if you do the history of it, it does say, you know, it was meant for they were actually going to use that around the Vietnam era, and then but the military decided to go upgrade that the M16. So I use that as like, hey, our military was going to use this weapon for war, and rightfully so. I mean, it is a weapon that can shoot very fast, can cause a lot of damage that way. And that's, you know, and yeah, I mean, I do believe in self-defense, but I don't think people need a weapon like that for self-defense, you know, and I think, you know, we do need to have people come together to have these conversations. So what can we do to bring shootings down? You know, not be afraid to talk to each other and get stuff done. So, and I think we need to get rid of lobbyists like the NRA. I think that's a huge problem.
I think you and I would be on the same page there. I don't have a lot of so when you get to the development of the AR-15, which is an Armalite, back when Armalite was developing this, it was a 1950s military rifle, but it didn't really sell too well. But
right.
And people started using it for hunting, target practice, and shooting. But what I would tell you is you kind of defined why people would have an AR-15 when you were asking about the well-regulated militias. Now, I find that the left will try to use this as a way to say, well, why do we need a militia, you know, or you need a militia in order to be able to have this type of weapon, and it needs to be well-regulated. And we don't have that throughout most of this country, except in certain states. So therefore, the Second Amendment doesn't apply. But that's not necessarily what was being mentioned by all that. And we can go to different papers by Hamilton. We can see what the framers were thinking when they wrote the Constitution beyond that. And so when we get down to it, what they were really looking for was they wanted to make sure there was never any type of government like what had happened in Britain. And so they wanted to make sure that the country itself would not have to fund an army, but the people themselves could be an army against both a foreign threat and a domestic threat. So the simple part of the Constitution created a well-regulated militia simply by giving people that right. And that's something that the left really overlooks. They look over the intent to try to go, well, look at these words. Meanwhile, the word, if I say, well, look at these words from a right perspective or a more conservative perspective, I'd say, shall not be infringed. And the left is not like that. So I think that the left gets hung up on well-regulated, the conservatives get caught up on shall not be infringed. And as a result, we're all teeter-tottering on this seesaw. Yeah. Nothing gets done. And I would say that we do have a violence problem in this country. You and I would both acknowledge that we shouldn't have so many young people dying by gun violence in our cities. We shouldn't have schools where there are shootings that are a regular occurrence in this country. It's a travesty that this is going on. I'm a high school teacher. I see it. I understand what the statistics are in this country. It's horrifying. But I don't think we can have a conversation because we get caught up on some of these talking points like you just mentioned, instead of the talking point of, David, can you tell me why in the most liberal cities throughout this country that have the most damning gun laws on the books already, we also have the most amount of gun violence daily in each of those places, like Chicago, like in Trenton, New Jersey, Wilmington, Delaware, where I'm from, Philadelphia. I think 379 young people were shot in Philadelphia just last year. Trending, I think they're at like 158 already here in 2023. You know, if the gun laws work so well, then we wouldn't have this problem. I think what it comes down to, and I think that this will resonate with you, I think that what it comes down to is we really have got a problem with respect for one another, for understanding and compassion. We lack empathy as a society. We rush the judgment of people. We troll people way too fast. And we have kind of this culture of, I got to get you back. And it's found its way in the gangs. It's found its way into people reacting way too quickly, whether it's on social media with ugly comments instead of caring comments to try to have compassion and understanding. And it's allowing people to pull the trigger proverbially as well as figuratively, literal and figural along the way. I mean, are you seeing this, David, or am I oversimplifying any of that?
You're absolutely correct. And I think part of the issues are like I said before, you know, the difference between cities and states that have lesser laws, they bring the weapons over, and we gotta find a way to deal with criminals who shouldn't have guns to begin with. You know, not a lot's been talked about with that too, and I do think we need to invest more in mental health. I'm studying to be a social worker, and this is my second year. And in the bachelor's program, I should be, I'm starting the second year. I should be getting my degree less than a year.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And it just for a short time of classes, it's sort of like helping me understand a lot part of the problems that we have in these cities. And you know, mental health is a huge thing. And I think we need to source more in that. Mental health, social services, just like, you know, the case with Jordan Neely. I think the system completely failed him. And the system was better. You know, he wouldn't have so many arrests to begin with. You know, they could have possibly done something for him, you know, his first crime that he committed. You know, everything's like that. It's like, you know, we got into the system of mental health, fix problem. I just see our country as a broken country when it comes to that. And then, you know, there definitely needs to be policy changes and to help out with that.
Yeah, I did a show about 2 weeks ago on the mental health decline in this country using some Gallup polls and some studies. And depression, self-reported depression, as well as depression that has been both diagnosed by a professional, is now at, I believe it was 42% of Americans have either been diagnosed or self-diagnosed themselves as having depression or anxiety. And that number is actually pretty horrifying when you think about it, because there's either one of two things are going on. And I think it's all related back to 2020 as far as the upswing. But when people got into that social isolation of what COVID was doing to people, and you see the death clock going up and people were scared, businesses were shut down, we were having funerals, we couldn't attend the funerals, we couldn't see our loved ones in hospitals. I think that really gave people anxiety, led people into depression. But then we also have created this side of society now that says, it's okay to have mental health issues. It's a normal experience, and we want to help you through it. So now I think people are reporting it because the stigma has started to go away. But when the stigma has gone away, I don't know that we've got better at treating it, right? I think you're absolutely correct. We still need to do much more in how to treat mental health. And I think part of the problem with that is, much like our political system, mental health seems to be stigmatized in the same way with a left and right view. I'm sure you see it all the time with, you know, the issues going on just between Target, Adidas, trans rights, LGBTQ, you have the side that goes, well, this is a mental health issue, a side that goes, all right, well, it's a mental health issue, let's really love them and care for them and do as much as we can, a side that says, well, we need to be tough with them. And then you have the extremes on both of the other parts of that. And we, again, can't get things done. So I think that's going to be a challenge for you as a social worker, especially just working through both the feelings as well as what's right for the individual. There's not a right answer for that right now, and it's getting more and more complex by the day, it feels.
Absolutely. And I think when it comes to mental health, it shouldn't be politicized. Unfortunately, right? This country is getting worse and worse by the day, polarizing. And, you know, I find myself having that problem too when I see certain Republicans tweeting, and I try to be civil. And, you know, for the most part, when it comes to, like, voters or other commentators, I am. But when it comes to people like Marjorie Taylor Greene or Kevin McCarthy, it's like, you know, they're doing this purposely, and
I have called out Marjorie Taylor Greene multiple times on my show. I would say that Marjorie Taylor Greene is the worst of the right, and AOC, she's actually starting to soften a little bit. She's not as cantankerous as she was when she first got in, but AOC was the left's Marjorie Taylor Greene, with kind of like just false feelings and sensationalizing everything to the point where it wasn't always factual. But Marjorie Taylor Greene, just with no decorum whatsoever, she's the idiot side of the Republican Party, and AOC is the the bad rub side of the left, I believe.
Go ahead.
I feel like then you also have the fact that there's a bunch of invalids that are now the left is propping up, like Fetterman, Feinstein's being wheeled in, and it's not a good look for the left, right? To see these individuals that are having trouble performing their duties, and the left is okay with it because they don't have somebody better to put in place. And I think what's even more damning, David, is all the right had was Dr. Oz to put up against Fetterman. So what's that say about the right? I mean, The bullpen in the stable seems empty of good choices for America. So we all lose in the end.
Yeah, very true. It's definitely a tough time for both parties, I think, with the right candidates and everything. But I don't think AOC is nowhere near like the Marjorie Taylor Greene on the left. I mean, yeah, she's far from perfect, and sometimes doesn't always get it right, but I think her intentions are good, and she just cares a lot about people. I'm trying not to be biased because I am liberal, and I don't consider myself far left because I don't agree with everything AOC says, but But I think that's like not a big, definitely not a good comparison. There's no one. I mean, there's no one.
I guess
right, like Marjorie Taylor Greene. Even Lauren Boebert is like, yeah, she's like not always right, but she's sort of like, you know, human.
She's a little bit more human about kind of what she approaches, although she still sometimes says absolutely idiotic things that she comes out with.
All right. Marjorie Taylor Greene is in a whole.
But I'd ask you to kind of reevaluate at some point after this interview about AOC and reevaluate some of the stuff that she's posted, and specifically going down to the border, crying at the fence. Meanwhile, she wasn't actually looking at anything. It was fake tears at that point. I mean, she might have been upset over it. Absolutely. But a lot of that's been debunked with her. She's kind of a social media influencer as a congressperson, more than somebody who's really at the front lines of making the laws. She's really being handled in a lot of ways to be that face. And she does that extremely well. But that's where that comparison with Marjorie Taylor Greene comes. They both are sensationalist in what they do and or the back. The only thing that I would say is I think AOC over the last 6 months, 7 months has calmed down a ton and is a little bit more palatable. And I can admit that. I would say I can't compare her over the last 6 months, but the first part of her time in Congress, I definitely would make that comparison. Now that gets us into the conversation of this upcoming presidential election. So just earlier, we got to hear from Ron DeSantis, who announced on Twitter Spaces with Elon Musk after a disastrous crashing of Twitter that he was going to be running for president of the United States, to the surprise of absolutely no one. We all saw this coming. But I'll tell you what horrified me as somebody that's more of a libertarian. What horrified me is the fact that everybody keeps telling me that I shouldn't trust Elon Musk. And the reason they tell me is, well, he's got an agenda. When I listen to this tonight, this stunk of the elites picking who they want for president. When it comes to Elon Musk, he's got this platform where he can influence hundreds of millions around the world. And he used this not to help Tim Scott with his Republican nomination the other day on Monday. He didn't use this with RFK Jr. in an official way. RFK Jr. announced his own campaign for the Democrats. He didn't use this for Nikki Haley. But all of a sudden, Ron, he gets him in the room with his people, his team. He's got these prepared remarks, and they celebrate that Twitter is this beacon where they can put this out. Should we be concerned that the next election will not be fair because it's going to be heavily influenced by what the owners of Twitter would like to see happen?
Yeah, it is, Stephanie. You bring up a lot of good points. If I was Ron DeSantis, the first one, I'd have incumbent president candidate. Which other Republican candidates, but no, he picked Ron DeSantis. And I don't know. I was very, very critical in the beginning of when Elon Musk first took over. And I sort of softened up a little bit and realized, you know, maybe he's not really a bad guy. I do think that he does sort of have like an agenda, and the problem is he follows too many people on the right. I think that's part of his problem. So, because, you know, I've been down that rabbit hole. I know what it's like. I know how easy it is to get sucked down into that place. And I tried several times trying to tell him, you know, and he has replied to me a couple of times. So I do give him the benefit of the doubt, you know, or, you know, that, you know, he is hearing what I'm saying. You know, he doesn't reply to all of my tweets. But I do think he really needs to follow more liberals. And I'm not saying me. You know, there's plenty of people out there who's more expertise than I am. And, you know, and I think that would sort of like help Ron in his worldview on things. But yeah, I think that's the biggest issue right now. Elon, you know, is following like 90% of the liberal or right wing accounts. And I mean, there's going to be reasons why people think that he did this too, and try to get Trump to lure him back into Twitter as well. So that's a possibility. Because, you know, Trump goes back on Twitter, that would help, you know, with his profit, you know, being the owner or former owner. I don't know if he's still making money off of it. I know he sold part of it to I don't remember her name, but she's like a former NBC person.
Right.
But yeah, that is some of his questionable, and it's really hard to pinpoint like what exactly his agenda. He says he's more free speech, but he uses the extreme right interpretation of free speech, not the actual First Amendment of what the First Amendment says. And you know, it's obvious there are those who are educated in that area that, I mean, you know, he's following right wing, you know, interpretations of everything. And yeah, it's definitely a dangerous, slippery slope. And you know, who knows where Joe Winter is going to be in a couple, in a year or so from now, especially during an election. It's going to be a scary time, I think. Very intense time when it comes.
I think at the end of the day, and I could be completely wrong on this, I think at the end of the day that it's going to once again be Joe Biden against Donald Trump. I don't know why I believe that in my heart of hearts, but I see that as what's coming down. Now, I don't know that Joe Biden's going to make it to the election. That's a whole other can of worms that I kind of have been listening to as a resident of Delaware. People give me information. So I don't know from a health perspective if he'll be running for president in 2 years still at that election time. But if he is and he stays healthy enough, I believe it's going to be Biden Trump. And I got to ask you, so you've moved over to Biden during this time. I'm not a Biden fan. I'm not a Biden fan for a lot of reasons. One is I live in the state of Delaware where he's from. I've personally met Joe. My mother worked for the Biden campaign years ago. She was at different events with Bo Biden and Joe and his wife, Jill. When I walk in my parents' house, we got photos of Joe Biden and Jill Biden with my parents. And it's a little bit awkward now that I do this show and I've done some of the content that I've done. My question I'm going to ask you is this. You voted, I'm assuming, in the 2020 election for Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. Are you proud of the job that he's done?
Yeah, I mean, I know he's not perfect. No one's perfect, but I believe that he's trying really hard, given what he's dealt with and the kind of Congress that he has to work into. You know, he's doing the best that he can. And it's kind of hard, I mean, it's very hard, especially when you have a party that sees you as the enemy. I mean, how do you work with a part, you know, how do you work with that? So I think he's doing the best he can. I mean, there were some hard decisions, you know, can things have done better? Absolutely. But yeah, I'm part of the working side, and he certainly has my vote again. I have no problem putting Joe Biden again in 2024.
Okay. And then so you'd mentioned earlier about corruption with Donald Trump.
Right.
Do you acknowledge that there is any corruption with Joe Biden?
There's always a possibility, which is why I ask for evidence every time they bring it up. And you know what? And, you know, if there is actual evidence of wrongdoing, I will say, hey, that's not okay. No one is above the law, regardless if you're a Democrat or Republican. So yeah, if there is actual wrongdoing of Joe Biden, I will condemn it. And
So this is kind of where I have a problem a little bit with your statement and the left, not just you, but with the statement from the left about if there's evidence. Mm-hmm. I want you to apply that same standard to Donald Trump just for a quick moment. Yeah. So if there's evidence, then it's fine. I mean, did you read the Durham report that came out last week?
Yeah, I did.
To get through? So I thought that some of the takeaways from it wasn't really, if anything, I was like, why didn't he interview Comey? Why didn't he interview some of the people that really matter? But at the end of the day, the main takeaways that I got from it, and tell me if you got something different, because I want to try to get on the same page on this.
Okay.
From reading it, I saw that the FBI did a really, really bad investigation that they now, in hindsight, know, and they've made laws or policy, I guess I should say. They made policies to make sure that doesn't happen again. But the spying on Donald Trump's campaign should never have happened based upon the standards of which the FBI operates. That was pretty clear in that report. The second thing that has already been clear, because there were charges pressed with it, was the Steele dossier, which the left used for months upon months and then years upon years to say Russia collusion. That was the Golden Shower document. We now know that that was financed by the DNC with an uncorroborated source, which was based through Yahoo. Not that there's a whole different part I can go into that, but that would take too long. And it traces all the way back to Hillary Clinton's campaign. And so when I look at that, I go, okay, I hear what you're saying when I ask you the question about, you know, could Biden be considered that he's corrupt? And you said, well, I'd have to see the evidence. But I don't think that people needed to see the evidence back when Trump was president, because the Durham report tells me that people went off false evidence, that they made their mind up for years. We now know that Russia collusion, was there Russia influencing on the election? Yeah, the Mueller report shows that. But the Mueller report and now the Durham report also show that no one that actually was working on Donald Trump's campaign, including Donald Trump himself, was active in that collusion. It was more kind of what countries do to have election interference to try to influence which way the election is moving. And that is, I think, the big lie from the left. Like, the big lie on the right is the election fraud of 2020. The big lie on the left is Russia collusion. And the Durham report should put an end to that, but I'm still hearing it said. So after that, are you still looking at Donald Trump as corrupt with Russia? I think Donald Trump's corrupt as anything when it comes to the way he does real estate and business, because that's what all of those people do. But I'm just narrowing this down to Russia. Would your views change now in hindsight, reading that report, from what MSNBC and all these others said about Donald Trump? Is he vindicated in any way?
Maybe to an extent, when it comes to like the collusion part, yeah, but there's still so many questions. Like, you know, what was talk about Putin and Putin behind closed doors? And I kind of felt like how irresponsible Trump is. You know, I believe that sort of put our country at risk. And you know, I know, you know, that he had a lot of corruption stuff going on with Putin in a way prior before his presidency too. But yeah, collusion stuff, I don't know. And I still have questions like, what about Paul Manafort? What about Michael Flynn? You know, why isn't that being addressed too? So, mm-hmm. And I still have questions. So, but I, you know, and even Mueller and Barr said that he's not fully exonerated. So there's that as well. So I'm not an expert on that. So it's kind of hard to say exactly, like, but yeah, when it came to about the Ukrainian phone call, I read everything I read. I looked at the evidence there, and that's why I based my own decision why I believe Trump should be impeached and removed. He should have been removed. But as far as Russian collusion, it's a very iffy, and I'm willing to admit, so kind of iffy. Maybe there should have been no impeachment there, but, you know, it's a hard call with that one.
Yeah, but I think it's such an important conversation to have with both sides, the right and the left, and bring people together because of this. If that never happens at the beginning of his presidency, I think that Donald Trump's entire legacy is completely different. Then maybe we just focus on the fact that he talked like a jackass during things and said things that really made people upset, but we focused more instead on policy, the fact we didn't get into any new wars, the economy was doing great up until COVID, and as a whole, the country wasn't going in a horrible direction, even though maybe there was deals with Putin back that we don't know about, but it wasn't affecting you and I, the average person.
It might not as bad today, possibly. So, I mean, it can, yeah, you're right. And you're right. We should have these conversations.
Yeah, I'm just thinking like that's the influence the media can have on a presidency for the next 4 years by getting a story that is not accurate. And let's be honest, the same thing's going on with the Bidens. I called this out. I said the right now has been all about Hunter Biden's laptop, all about Joe Biden. Where is he getting money from? The Biden crime syndicate. I know this upset some of my listeners because they wrote to me about it. But my point is, until you show me evidence, you can have all the press conferences you want. I've interviewed John Paul MacIsaac. I know that the laptop is real. I know that there is horrifying, horrible stuff from Hunter Biden on that laptop. Yeah. I know that it makes his family look like a piece of crap, but there's not one thing that says that Joe Biden is corrupt that I've seen or I've heard. And until somebody can say, no, this is the damning piece of evidence and this is where it connects, then I got to say you're on the same exact witch hunt.
And you see that people on the left says, yeah, Hunter Biden's a freak. He is a piece of, you know, all of these things. But yeah, but I voted for Joe Biden. I didn't vote for Hunter Biden. And that's the point.
But the same standard, again, I'm just trying to go to the same standards applied to Donald Trump. They'd be calling for Eric Trump or Don Jr. to be thrown in prison. The left would have covered this every single night.
You know, partly as administration, though, right? I mean, that's the difference.
Well, it's not really that much different because Hunter Biden was flying on Air Force Two when he was vice president, which makes him, by default, by proxy, official business of the vice president of the United States.
And that was a big mistake.
Yep. And I mean, so that's why I asked the question of, could you see that, you know, Biden could be corrupt and should this be? Because I think, David, I really have enjoyed this conversation with you. And I've really enjoyed our interactions on Twitter because I find you to be willing to be thoughtful. I haven't found you to be a troll whatsoever. So I'm glad that you stopped doing that.
I'm
told all the time that I could probably have a lot more followers on Twitter if I would troll people or be meaner, but that's not who I am. What I want to ask you here is it possible you've pushed too far to the left? Is it possible that maybe you're too far over here and you have not seen the moderate side now that you've kind of moved?
There's a couple things. There's a couple issues that are, like, when it comes to LGBTQ, I mean, I love them, I support them all heartedly, and then I kind of wonder, you know, maybe that's the right point about what, you know, trans women playing in women's sports, maybe are they right about that, you know? It's like, and part of me says they are, and then it's like, and it's kind of hard to, like, sort of, like, really say anything, because, like, if you say it, we'll get to push back from your own people, so it's sort of like, you know, so it's hard to just sometimes, though, trying to get out of the echo chamber to have your own views on things. So, yeah, I mean, I still have some conservative views on certain issues, and sometimes the right does make good points on certain things, and, you know, we shouldn't be able to say that, but, you know, it's kind of hard to, because it's so tribal. I compliment Buzz sometimes when I get trolled and, like, oh, you went and done Twitter blue, I'm all following you now. Or something like, it's so crazy, just like that.
Right. I mean, I think that this conversation, I just had on another show the other day, they had me on as a guest, and I said, the problem with the right is they don't take into consideration that people have feelings. You know, feelings are a real thing that's complex. You know, you hear people like Ben Shapiro on the Daily Wire say, facts don't care about your feelings. Well, damn it, Ben. Feelings still matter, because at the end of the day, feelings cause people to do both amazing as well as horrible things when their feelings get hurt or they get complimented, right? People do loving actions, they're very giving, or they can get violent because their feelings are hurt. And so I find that when you get into those conversations about trans conversations, LGBTQ, you have two different ways of approaching it. You have people that understand that there's a human being on the other side of that label. And you have people that go, I don't care about the human being on the other side. This is just my view. I don't gel well with the latter. I like to make sure that I picture the person that's on the other side. And perhaps if we could have that conversation about sports, we could have that conversation about society and what's going on in classrooms and in schools, and maintain the feelings, we could bridge the gap in that conversation between the right and the left.
I absolutely agree with you. And I think we shouldn't try to do that. We should try to bring our sides closer to have these discussions.
Well, David, I appreciate your time joining me here on the show. Anything you want to add to my listeners? Any parting words before I wrap things up today?
You can follow me on Twitter at David M. Weissman. And I appreciate you listening to the segment.
I appreciate you being on. I just got to ask, I promised you we'd hit this at one point, and it's the wrap up. Wrestling fan, who is the greatest pro wrestler of all time?
My favorite wrestler, The Undertaker.
The Undertaker. All right, so you're going late 90s Undertaker, or are you going 2000s Undertaker?
Early 90s.
Okay, that's the right one. I like that. Where does the Ultimate Warrior fit on that scale for you?
I would say he's top 10.
Top 10, okay. We're in the same spot. Now, my favorite one was a bit of a character. Do you remember Hacksaw Jim Duggan?
Oh.
Yes, you do. That's awesome. David, you got points on my book just then for giving me the hoe. That is awesome. Yes, he used to go in there. He'd have a 2x4 walking in. It was like 6 feet long. And he'd get out and he'd go, ho, and the whole stadium would go that way too. That was a blast back then.
Well,
awesome.
Classic.
Excellent. So yeah, WWF days. That's right. Before they had to switch over to WWE because the World Wildlife Foundation did not like that whatsoever.
Yeah. They certainly knew.
Well, everybody, I hope that you give David a follow, because the reason I follow him, he takes me outside my echo chamber of a lot of the people that I hear from. And I also find that if you engage with him, he's not somebody that's going to be hateful and come back at you. He's somebody that will stick to his points. But I find him to be very thoughtful in his responses. So if you enjoyed hearing from him today, please do go follow at David M. Weissman on Twitter. Come join the conversations when we're on to the Twitter spaces. He's normally around for those too, with Mara Norfall. Sometimes even Elon Musk makes his way into those rooms. So come be part of that family over there too. And I hope that we all honored your time well today, everybody. That's it. That's all. We'll be back tomorrow with yet another episode of America Emboldened with Greg Bolden, and today with my special guest, David Weissman, here on the America Out Loud Network. Be bold, America.